perfect and harsh.
Yeah, no. The only person who wasn't ready was me. So welcome to the second half of the school. Some things changed, some things don't. And the thing that hasn't changed is that John's lecture this morning. But unfortunately, he's the final of his lectures on the understanding model. He has another two of his musketeers at the back there. Well, they collaborate, so they do. They spend their time plotting last night. I don't know what they're going to do. Start this morning, continuing where we left off on Saturday in John's lectures on the understanding model.
Okay, thank you. So, I sort of... Mike? Mike's on? Supposed to.
Yeah.
It's okay. So, told you on Saturday how wonderful supersymmetry was. Unfortunately, of course, supersymmetry hasn't actually been seen yet. So what I plan to do in the first half of this lecture is review with you where we are with constraints on supersymmetry and what the masses of supersymmetric particles might be. And then in the second half of the lecture, I'm going to go off onto a sort of rag bag of other topics like grand unification and black holes and stuff, depending on how much time I have left. Probably, I'm sorry to say, I'm going to go a bit faster today than I've been going in my... Anybody there? Yes. So sorry that probably today I'm going to go a bit faster because I've got a fair amount of material to go through. So, particles have not been seen at LEP. Not yet seen at the Tevatron. The Higgs has not been seen. B decays into S gamma at more or less the standard model rate. One clear indication that we have for the existence of something beyond the standard model is the density of dark matter, which is actually quite well constrained. There is sometimes another indication of physics beyond the standard model, which is G minus 2. I'll come back to that in just a second. So, G minus 2. So, those of you who've been following this will know that there are two different ways of calculating the standard model contribution to enormous magnetic moment of the muon. One is using low energy E plus E minus data, and the other one is using tau decay data. This is in order to evaluate diagrams where in a loop you've got a virtual photon correction to the enormous magnetic moment going through either a hadron loop. So it's been well known for quite some time that these low energy plus E minus data and the tau decay data give you somewhat different stories. According to the latest evaluation that I show here by Davier et al., which came out a month or so back, whether you use E plus E minus data or tau decay data, in both cases you get some discrepancy between the standard model calculation and the experimental measurement. In one case it's only about 2 standard deviations, in one case it's about 3.5. Now the situation has got further muddied on Friday when some data were shown, preliminary data from the Babar collaboration. They have a new technique for measuring low energy plus E minus cross section using radiative return from higher energies. And their data, shown here in red, did not agree so well with the previous low energy plus E minus data from the Chloe collaboration. And it seems that if you use them, the Babar data, to calculate the enormous magnetic moment of the muon, you get a result very similar to that from the tau decay data. So these things are not yet finalised. I think we're going to have to wait for a while for the dust to settle down. But what this does mean is that people are not exactly sure whether or not the G minus 2 should be used as a constraint on the supersymmetric parameter space, and what I present later on I will sometimes include it, sometimes not include it. Okay, so here is a generic picture of the parameter plane of the constrained MSSM that I introduced yesterday, Saturday, which has a universal supersymmetry breaking parameter M1/2 for the Gaijino masses and a universal parameter M0 for the scalar supersymmetry breaking parameters for the slab-top masses. So the constraints shown on this slide assume that the lightest supersymmetric particle is a neutralino. Now, as I discussed on Saturday, it's not necessarily the case. The lightest supersymmetric particle could perhaps be a gravitino, for example. And I focus here on the neutralino scenario. So there's a region of this plane here which is excluded, because there the lightest supersymmetric particle will be charged. And that conflicts with the available astrophysical evidence. There's a region over here which is excluded by the fact that the DS gamma more or less agrees with the standard model. There is a thin blue line here, which is the region where you get the right relic density constraint. Now, some people look at this and say, oh, well, that means the supersymmetry has to be extremely finely tuned in order to get the right amount of cold dark matter. But remember that the density of cold dark matter is now measured with an accuracy of a few percent. So it's clear that whatever model you have, its parameters are going to be constrained to within a few percent by the dark matter density. So this is where the constraint sits for this particular choice of the mixing parameters that I mentioned. There's a couple of vertical lines here which are the constraints imposed by lead. Not having seen chargenos and not having seen the Higgs, it should be to the right of those two lines. There's some fuzziness in them, but roughly speaking, to the right of those lines. The pink diagonal band is, if you can see it, the band which is favoured by G minus 2 at the two standard deviation level if you believe in the low energy E plus E minus data. If you were to believe in the tau decay data, then this band would shift outwards. Roughly speaking, this solid line would move to a little bit to the right of this dashed line, and this solid line would move somewhere out there in the plane. So putting all these constraints together, what you see is that there is a narrow strip which is consistent with all the constraints. And if you believe in G minus 2, then you would favour the bottom end of this, corresponding to relatively small masses for the supersymmetric particles. Okay, now what I'm going to show you is a few slides from a recent paper that the two guys sitting at the back and I and some of our collaborators put out last month, which is a global likelihood analysis of the supersymmetric parameter space, including the G minus 2 constraint. So for inscrutable sociological reasons, instead of having M1/2 on the horizontal axis and M0 on the vertical axis, which is now M0 on the horizontal axis and M1/2 on the vertical axis. So axes reversed by comparison with the previous one. The left hand is the CMSSM, that's the one that you saw previously. The right hand is this slightly more complicated model that I introduced on Saturday morning, in which the supersymmetric breaking contributions to the Higgs masses are non-universal, so non-universal Higgs masses. So these pictures are sort of qualitatively similar. In both cases, you see that relatively light values for the supersymmetric particle masses are favoured. You can just about make out these little white dots here, which correspond to the best fit points. And then there are lines here corresponding to the 68% and 95% confidence region in this likelihood analysis. So, relatively low masses seem to be favoured. So these are various different contributions to the global likelihood function chi-squared. Perhaps I should just step back for a second. There are some people who, for some inscrutable reason, like large values for the the supersymmetric particle masses, something which I haven't really discussed called the focus point. And on this slide here with the contributions of the global chi-squared, you see that that focus point region at large values of particle masses, which is shown in this column over here, is strongly disfavored, in particular by G minus 2, but also by some of the other observers. Now, this sort of likelihood analysis obviously depends on the implementation of the constraints. Now, we've already discussed the fact that it's sensitive to G minus 2. Back to the top panels up here, you see that G minus 2 in blue is the constraint to which the analysis is most sensitive. And in the bottom left hand here, you see that if you change your implementation of G minus 2 by inflating or reducing the error, then the region of parameter space that you favor expands or contracts correspondingly. Although if you keep the same central value, obviously the same best fit point will be favored. So things are sensitive to G minus 2. Things are also sensitive to B decay and to S gamma. Not so sensitive, but still fairly sensitive. So for example, this sort of analysis depends very strongly on an assumption of scalar mass universality in the Sprague sector, which might not necessarily be true. Anyway, I imagine that Gino Isidori, another one of our collaborators, in his lectures will probably be discussing supersymmetric flavor physics in a bit more detail. Oops, I don't think we need that. Okay. So this is a sketch of what happens if you drop the G minus 2 constraint entirely. So the red lines show you that if you incorporate G minus 2 using the donor G plus E minus data, then low values of the supersymmetric masses are very definitely favored, and large values are disfavored by delta chi squared 9, 10, whatever. However, if you drop G minus 2, then you get this dashed line. So you see that although low masses are still favored, they're not favored by very much, delta chi squared 2 or something like that. But it's actually interesting. What this means is that there is some other, well, there are some other indications in the data which also favor relatively light supersymmetric particle masses. And one of those is the measurement of the mass of the W. And I imagine that Sven will be discussing in quite some detail what goes into the mass, some detail. A little bit of detail. What goes into that? Okay, so I've shown you what happens with and without G minus 2. Now I'm going to go through a few slides assuming G minus 2. So this is the M0, M1 half plane. Same one that I showed a couple of slides back, but now somewhat cleaned up. So over here, you've got a charged supersymmetric relic, which is not allowed. Down here, this region is excluded by NEP and tevatron searches. According to our likelihood analysis, this blue region is favored in 68% confidence range, and the red region is favored in 95% confidence range. Also shown on here are lines corresponding to the sensitivity of the LHC with various amounts of integrated luminosity and various different possible center of mass energies. So, as you know, the LHC is going to start with 7 TeV in the center of mass, and then it's hoped already in the first half of next year to crank it up to 10 TeV in the center of mass, and the accelerator guys claim that they should be able to get a couple of hundred inverse picobarns of luminosity at 10 TeV. Well, that would be great, because that would give you a sensitivity in this plane which is probably somewhere around this green dashed line. The green dashed line is 100 inverse picobars at 14 TeV, probably, roughly speaking, for these purposes, equivalent to 210 TeV. So what you see is that that would already be able to cover the 68% confidence level region. And with one inverse femtobar, you'd be able to cover the entire 95% region. So that looks quite cheerful for a prospective early discovery of supersymmetry at the LHC. So guys and girls, keep your eyes peeled next year. So there are various different possible signals that you might be looking for. You might be looking for plane missing energy with leptons. You might be looking for dileptone events. That's quite an interesting signature. In fact, it's even possible with a bit more luminosity that you might see the Higgs in cascade decays of heavier supersymmetric particles. So, plenty of different channels to look for. So those two slides that I just showed you were in the simplest possible supersymmetric model, which surely wrong. Sure that life has been more complicated. I don't know exactly in what way life is going to be more complicated. But anyway, the second simplest model is this one here, the non-universal Higgs model. But you see the picture is very much the same there. Again, the initial running of the LHC next year, with a bit of luck, should cover the 68% confidence level region. And again, there are these various different respective supersymmetric channels which you could look at. So this is our latest plot of the likely ranges of different supersymmetric particle masses. So each of these, the little vertical bar here, indicates the best fit value. The solid line indicates the 68% confidence level range, and the dotted line indicates the 95% confidence level range. So, well, let's start at the bottom, because that's this particle that you would be most likely to produce at the LHC, that's the Gluino. So what you see is that our best fit value for the Gluino mass is somewhere in the range, 600 to 800 GeV, and it probably weighs less than 1 TeV, although it might weigh as much as 1.5 TeV. So there's quite a fair amount of uncertainty in these estimates. Nevertheless, the general impression is quite positive. Squarks are probably a little bit lighter than the Gluino, but that's not necessarily the case. I'll come back to that. Weakly interacting sparticles, because they get less renormalization, as I discussed on Saturday, those are generally considerably lighter. And right up the top here, you see that the preferred value for the lightest supersymmetric particle mass, the dark matter candidate, is around 100 GeV. Now, one thing that you do not see on here is the Higgs. So this, I'm sure, we'll discuss in more detail. And it's nodding vigorously. So this is the likelihood function for the lightest Higgs mass in the CMSSM and the NUHN1. So as I mentioned on Saturday, one of the beauties of supersymmetry is that you can calculate the lightest Higgs mass and you predict that it's going to be pretty light. In the case of the CMSSM, the preferred value is a little bit less than 110 GeV, but there are theoretical uncertainties, double-delta chi-squared of 1, completely compatible with the lower limit of 114 GeV. In the case of the NUHM1, the preferred value for the Higgs mass is actually a little bit heavier. So the tension here with the experimental limit is not severe, and here there's no tension whatsoever. So here's a little bit more about the lightest neutralino mass. I won't discuss the dashed lines, let's just focus on the solid lines. So as I said, what you expect both in the CMSSM and in the NUHM1, is that the lightest supersymmetric particle, dark matter candidate, would weigh about 100 GeV. However, you can see that at the level of delta chi squared of 4, maybe it would weigh as much as 250 GeV. So, of course, having some idea about what the LSB mass might be is of interest for the LHC. It's also of interest for people who are planning dark matter detection experiments. And we have something in our paper about the prospects for those, but I won't discuss that. This is supposed to be an LHC. Now, I commented earlier on that the Cluino is probably the particle that should be most likely to produce at the LHC. That's the sort of the originator of all the supersymmetric decay cascades. It's interesting to look to see what is the relationship between the Cluino and the Sprott mass. Now, what you see from this is that the best fit point and the most likely region of parameter space, the Cluino is actually heavier than the squats. However, it's not necessarily the case, in fact, you see over here, in particular in the NUHM1, that it's possible that the squats would actually be heavier than the Cluino. This actually has implications for how easy it is going to be to find all the supersymmetric spectroscopy. If the squarks are lighter than the Cluino, then you produce them in Cluino decays. If they're heavier, well, it's the other way around. The cross-section producing squarks is somewhat smaller than that for producing Cluino, so life would be a bit tougher in that case. Another plot which is interesting for people who are thinking about future linear colliders is the correlation between the neutralino mass and the Stau mass. Stau is the supersymmetric partner of the Tau lepton. It's usually expected in these neutralino dark matter scenarios to be the second lightest supersymmetric particle. And the favoured region of parameter space, that little thin blue line that I showed you a few seconds back, the Stau is only slightly heavier than the neutralino. So that would mean that, for example, if you determine that the neutralino weighs 100 GeV, then the Stau would maybe be 120 GeV, and so then you would pair produce that copiously at a low energy linear collider. However, you can see here that although that's probably the case, that's not necessarily the case, and in particular in the NUHM1, the Stau could actually be quite a bit heavier than the lightest neutralino. So if the LHC in a burst of glory discovers supersymmetry next year, and if it is determined that the Gay-Geno mass scale is relatively light, just wait a little bit to try to figure out what is the pattern of supersymmetry breaking before deciding that you want to build a low-energy linear collider, because it could be that the charged supersymmetric particles are too heavy to produce. Okay, so that was something for the linear collider people. So the flavor physics people have been feeling a little bit hard done by. They weren't getting enough attention early on in the school. So I've got one plot for you. Okay. And this is the likelihood function for ds goes to mu plus mu minus. So on the left we have the prediction in the CMSSM, on the right we have the prediction in the NUHM1. And this little vertical bar here indicates the standard model prediction, including the error. What you see is that there is tremendous scope, in particular in NUHM1, for finding the value of BS goes to mu mu, which is different from what you get in the standard model. It's true that the most likely value looks similar to that in the standard model, but if you look at the if you integrate the likelihood function outside the blue band, there's actually a lot more of it than there is inside the blue band. So, LHCB guys and girls, next year you should have enough energy and enough luminosity to go for a quick win and measure BS goes to mu plus mu minus, and you have a good chance of finding something which is significantly larger than in the standard model. So, go for it. So, back to G minus 2. So, what you see here is in the dashed lines, these are in our likelihood analysis, including G minus 2 for mu plus mu minus annihilation, which is just one of the constraints that we implement in the appropriate errors. You have what we would predict to be the value of the supersymmetric contribution to G minus 2, the dashed line. So you see about 2 or 3 times 10 to the minus 9. Now, if we remove the G minus 2 constraint and say we don't believe any of these guys, we don't believe Chloe, we don't believe Babar, we don't believe the tau decay data, they're all for it, then you get the solid red line. So what is interesting is that the other data seem to be suggesting that there should be a supersymmetric contribution to G minus 2. Very large uncertainties, of course, but nevertheless, you know, the other data seem to be consistent with the idea that there might be a supersymmetric contribution to G minus 2. Now, this overlay here shows you the range for the supersymmetric contribution to G minus 2 that you would require if you believe in the tau decay calculation. And that's essentially the same as what you would get with the preliminary Babar data. So, if you should switch loyalty to the tau decay data, if you should prefer the Babar data over the previous frequency minus data, you would slightly shift the central value of our analysis. This would correspond to somewhat larger values for the supersymmetric analysis. But enormously much larger. So I would conclude from this that whichever of the estimates, standard model estimates of G minus 2 you believe, you should still be reasonably cheerful about the prospects of discovering supersymmetry soon at the LHC, unless we get completely full of it. So I think I'll pause at that point. That was the end of the supersymmetry phenomenology, and as I said, in the rest of the lecture I'm going to be talking about a bunch of other subjects, so maybe I pause for brickbats at this point. Yeah?
In some of the plot attributes in the beginning, two standard beta equal to 10, why? And what happened if you change it? Because they have this plot assumption that the beta equal to 10 and a equal to 0 will be good.
Yeah.
So what's happening here?
Thank you for that. Yeah, thank you for the question. So I showed you only tan beta equal to 10 because I didn't have enough time to show you the other plots that we've done for different values of tan beta. In fact, in the likelihood analysis, we do a likelihood analysis including tan beta as a parameter. So we sample all possible values of tan beta. And it turns out that tan beta equal 10 is the preferred value. So somewhere in my transparency stack I have the likelihood function for tan beta. It turns out tan beta equal to 10 is favored.
There were two labeled interests that I didn't quite understand, and I was wondering if you could go back and explain them. One was in the discovery reach plot, the no electroweak symmetry breaking area at the bottom. And the other one in the Higgs mass plot, the theoretical inaccessible area on the side.
Okay, so the absence of electroweak symmetry breaking. You may remember that on Saturday morning I said that one of the intriguing features of supersymmetry was that it enables you to break electroweak symmetry breaking starting off from positive Higgs mass squared and running them down to low energies, and you get a negative Higgs mass squared. mass squared. So if you like, the Higgs postulate of negative mass squared is no longer a postulate, it's actually something you derive from the structure of the theory. So that's possible in most of the plane, but not in that region. Okay? And, right, the other one as to the region which is theoretically inaccessible. What that just means is, that's a comment that I made also on Saturday, that in simple supersymmetric models, there is a maximum value of the Higgs mass that you can reach, which is somewhere around 130 GeV. And so it's not worth showing 250 GeV because supersymmetry never goes anywhere near that. So at the moment, the experimental error on the measurement of G minus 2 is roughly comparable to the error which is estimated both for the Stanwald calculations, either using tau decay data or using E plus E minus data. The trouble is that those determinations of the standard model contribution don't agree with one another. So there is clearly a problem. There is some sort of systematic error which is underestimated or miscalculated in one or the other, or both, I believe. Okay, it's not a statistical question, it's a systematic one. So, short of getting all the E plus E minus and tau decay people together in a room and not allowing them out until they've sorted out the problem, I don't really know very much what to do. I'm sure that it would be possible to further improve both determinations. There are, in principle, more tau decay data available from the B factors. There are other experiments working on low energy E plus E minus annihilation. So I think this is an ongoing story, and there are prospects for improving it. Unfortunately, although there is a proposal to improve the experimental measurement of G minus 2, the Brookhaven experiment, which has the best value, was told to stop. They haven't got any money to continue. But if any of you feel like writing a letter to your local congressperson urging them to provide money to realize the full potential of the experiment, that would be a great thing to do. Now, if you should be so lucky that you discover supersymmetry of the LHC, it would still be interesting to push this to the limit, because then you're actually checking supersymmetry at the loop level. So, at least initially at the LHC, you're just going to be checking the tree level value of supersymmetric parameters, model masses, couplings, and so on. The G minus 2 would be sensitive at the loop level, so that would be a very interesting thing to really pin that down and see whether the two things are. Anything else? So this is the claim that grand unification almost works in the standard model. If you take the measured values of couplings at low energies and extrapolate them to higher energies. But the agreement is improved if you include supersymmetry. So what I want to do in the next part of the lecture is discuss with you some simple grand unified theories and a little bit what goes into these calculations of the running of the couplings. Okay, so I think you've heard from earlier lectures, in particular from my brother Keith, about the logarithmic evolution of gauge coupling. So strong coupling varies logarithmically, couplings also vary logarithmically. Now, it's clear that if you want to have convergence to the same value for the strong coupling, which is of order 1 at low energies, and the weak coupling, which is of order, let's say, 1 over 100 at low energies, and if you're counting on logarithmic evolution to do it for you, you're going to have to wait a hell of a long time. Just, in fact, typically in such a scenario, the grand unified mass is going to be something like exponential of 1 over alpha times the weak mass. So that's basically why it is that the grand unification scale in all these scenarios is extremely high. Okay, now, what actually is it that you measure at low energies? Of course, you measure strong coupling. You also measure G2, the SU2 coupling. And you measure this parameter called sine squared theta, which is the related to the ratio of the SU2 and the U1 couplings. So, how does this parameter vary as the SU2 and U1 couplings vary? Well, the answer is shown here. This varies. So it's given by alpha electromagnetic divided by alpha 3, and there's a little coefficient x in here, and this x is related to the one loop coefficients in the renormalization group functions. So in the standard model, for example, SU3 at the one loop varies according to 11 minus 2/3 the number of quarks, which is 11 minus 2/3 the number of generations. And SU2, instead of 11, you get 22 over 3, and you get a contribution from the Higgses. And for U1, you don't get any of this 11 nonsense, you just get the number of generations and another contribution from the Higgses. So, we know how many generations there are, three of those, stick them into this formula, and you calculate this ratio of running as 23 over 218. Now you do the same thing for the minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model. The 11s become 9s, because of the contribution from the Arduinos. The 4/3 become 2s, because there's a contribution from the sparks and sleptons. And the contributions of the Higgses are a bit bigger, because there's no less of Higgsenos. Calculate this relevant ratio of one loop normalization functions, and you get 1/7. So, 1/7 in the minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model, and 0.1055 in the standard model itself. What do the data want? The data, so this is basically the value of alpha, the value of the strong coupling, and the measurement of sine squared theta w, which I advertised on the first lecture as being one of the high precision determinations of the precision electroweak data. X is 6.92 plus or minus 0.07. So that, I think, is fairly mind-boggling. You just put in the low energy measurements and you determine what renormalization you would need in order to unify them. And that is 1%. Within 1%, that's what you get in a supersymmetric theory. Now, okay. So what I just described was what happens at the one loop level. Okay, so here again, you see 9 instead of 11 in the supersymmetry, 6 instead of 22 over 3, and so on, contributions to number of generations, and the number of Higgs. So that's what you get at one loop in SSM. Now, since we're talking about doing a calculation, since we're talking about something at the level of 1%, obviously we should go to two loops. And so I won't bore you with the details, but these are the two loop contributions to the normalization group functions. Turns out that the results are remarkably stable. These are some that actually do include the two-loop contributions, but in the case of supersymmetry, whether you include or not the supersymmetric contribution, the two-loop contributions, you get essentially the same results. So I would claim that this is a success at something like 1% level, and that it is something which is relatively stable. There is, however, one little feature of this, which is the way in which the couplings are normalized changes when you cross the threshold for producing the supersymmetric particles. And in this particular plot here, one particular range of masses we put in for the supersymmetric particles. So, in order to get the dark matter, in order to stabilize the hierarchy, etc., 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 we expect supersymmetric particles to weigh something of the order of a TeV or so. And it turns out that within errors, putting them in around the TeV scale does the job. Okay, so what I've just discussed now is, if you like, a bottom-up approach. You take the measurements at low energies, you extrapolate them up to high energies, and you see what would be needed in order to make the gauge couplings become equal and hence unifiable at some exponentially high energies. But that was independent of any details of what the grand unified group might turn out to be. So let me just say a couple of words about that. So what you would like is a theory which not only unifies the different fundamental forces, but also somehow sticks quarks and leptons together in a somewhat tidier way than is done within the standard model. So I remind you that in the standard model, in each generation, you've got these are SU3 cross SU2 quantum numbers, you've got a singlet, doublet of leptons, you've got a triplet, doublet of quarks, you've got a singlet, this is the right-handed electron, or equivalently the left-handed positron, and then you've got two anti-triplet singlets, which are the left-handed anti-up and anti-down. So, fairly random-looking bunch of SU3 cross SU2 representations, and the hypercharges are also pretty random-looking as well. Now, one thing that you notice here is that particles and their antiparticles do not occur in the same representations. So you've got a lepton doublet, but you've got an anti-lepton singlet. So what that means is that if you're going to be looking for a grand unified group, which you group these particles into representations, the representation itself has to be complex. You can't imagine putting them in a real representation because then the particles and the antiparticles would transform equivalently. You would preferably like a model with an irreducible representation that you could stick all the particles of one generation into. That's not so easy to do. It's possible in a non-minimal model. Now, if you want to include SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, the minimal group, the minimal size of group that you would have, should have four simultaneously diagonalizable generators. So, in other words, four quantum numbers. Hypercharge, the weak isospin, and then two components of the SU3 color group. So you can look up in your favorite group theory book what are the groups of rank 4 and see whether they admit complex representations. And here is a list of candidate groups of rank 4. This is the only one which is an irreducible group which has complex representations. So this is why people fastened on SU5. The choice of SU5 is not random. It's the smallest group which has suitable representation to accommodate standard model particles and antiparticles in inequivalent representations. So what does the structure of SU5 look like? So you have a matrix representation, adjoint representation for the gauge bosons. So 5 is equal to 3 plus 2. This matrix has 3 by 3 submatrix, that's where the gluons are. 2 by 2 submatrix, that's where the W bosons are. And then there's some off-diagonal pieces with bosons, which I call X and Y, and I'll come back to the X and Y bosons later on. Matter particles. As I already said, ideally you would like to put all the matter particles of a single generation into a single irreducible representation. Turns out that doesn't happen in SU5, it happens in the next smallest unified group, but it doesn't happen in SU5. In SU5, the unique way to accommodate the fermions is in a five-dimensional representation and a 10-dimensional representation. This is an anti-symmetric matrix. So over here, we've got the down anti-quarks, the electron and neutrino, and over here, everybody else. Now, maybe I'll just say a couple of words about Higgs bosons. So in the standard model, you've got a single doublet of Higgs bosons. In the minimal supersymmetric extension, you've got two doublets of Higgs bosons. In SU5, you need two types of Higgs. There's one type of Higgs to break the grand unified group down to SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. And the simplest choice is, again, this 5x5 matrix adjoint representation. And then you need a second representation or representations to break SU2 cross U1 down to U1. So, this is what I've shown here is the Higgs content for the minimal grand unified theory. Of course, if you're making it supersymmetric, then you have to have two of these because we've got two Higgs doublets in the standard, the supersymmetric extension of the standard model. Now, I won't go through the discussion in great detail, but if you try to set up an effective Higgs potential in the standard model, which embeds this hierarchy where MW is much smaller than MGUT. And then if you calculate the range of corrections, everything goes haywire. And you know, unless you do incredible fine-tuning, it's not possible to prevent MW from rising up and become comparable to MGUT. This pattern of expectation values is unstable with regard to range of corrections in the standard model. However, but in supersymmetry, and as I discussed on Saturday, everything is fine. If you put in a large hierarchy of mass scales, then it's preserved under renormalization. So, is there any evidence at all that grand unified theories have anything to do with reality? So, grand unified theories, in the form that I've discussed them, were postulated for the first time over 35 years ago. And I think the one real success they can offer is the fact that the couplings could unify. And alternatively, you can say, well, if the couplings do unify, then you can predict the value of sine squared theta. And as I mentioned, that comes out correct to something like 1 part in 10 to the 3. Is there any other prediction of grand unified theories that has been verified? The answer is no, and I will discuss at least one prediction which has not been verified in a moment. Or perhaps maybe. Now, a couple of slides back, I mentioned that in the simplest models, the down type quarks electron in the same complement go through the algebra. That means that they have the same mass. is a very brief example. If you put the tau and the bottom quark together in the same multiplet, you would predict that the tau mass would be equal to the bottom mass. And I remember the moment when I realized that for the first time, and I said to myself, oh shit, this theory is real crap. And then, 5 seconds later, I realize, of course, it's going to be renormalized, this ratio, in the same way that the couplings are renormalized. And so we calculated this renormalization. And a few weeks before the bottom quark was discovered, we used the mass of the tau lepton to predict what the mass of the bottom quark should be. And the result, those days, the calculation was not very accurate, so we said 2 to 5. And then the bottom quark was discovered. So by that time, our paper had been accepted for publication. So we changed in proof to put 2 to 5 in the abstract of the paper, which was misread by the copy editor. So our published version says the prediction is the ratio between the bottom quark mass and the tau lepton mass is 2,605. Okay, anyway, so that's sort of a successful prediction. And this formula is in the case of the standard model. If you go to supersymmetry, then you get pretty much the same result. So that's sort of a success. Now, something which has not been a success for grand unified theories has been the prediction that baryons should decay. Oh, sorry, perhaps I should just back up. If we should be so lucky as to observe supersymmetric particles at the LHC and later on at the collider, then that sort of mass relationship between quarks and leptons would have its correspondence for mass relationships between quarks and leptons. So in that case, you might find a way of testing grand unified theories at the LHC and the collider. How about baryon decay? So you remember that I mentioned that there were some additional gauge bosons in the minimal SU5 model called X and Y. What interactions do they mediate? Well, the answer is that they mediate interactions which can change, for example, a couple of quarks here into an antiquark and an antileptic. And there are various different forms of those interactions. The sort of overall mathematical structure is similar to the way in which W exchange generates weak interactions. So you've got a sort of G gut, which is G squared over MX squared, the same thing you had G Fermi, which was G squared over W squared. So that gives you a proton lifetime, which varies like the fourth power of the mass of the supernovae bosons. M squared coming from the decay amplitude, m to the fourth when you square the amplitude to get the decay rate. Now, the preferred decay modes are extremely visible things, like proton goes to e plus pi zero, neutron goes to e plus pi minus, and so on. And in the original non-supersymmetric grand unified models, the prediction for the X and Y boson masses was around 10 to the 15 GeV. And you put in the numbers, and you predicted that the proton lifetime should be somewhere around 10 to the 31 years. Well, it ain't, at least not for these decay modes. For these decay modes, we know that the proton lifetime is longer than 10 to the 33 years, and some decay modes, we know the lifetime, the partial decay rate corresponds to a lifetime bigger than 10 to the 34 years. So, the simple non-supersymmetric SU5 prediction doesn't work. So, how about supersymmetry? So, in this case, the superheavy bosons are even super heavier. So the lifetime becomes longer, so that sounds good. Unfortunately, in addition to exchanging gut particles, you can also exchange gut spartacles. And typically the lifetimes that you get from exchanging gut spartacles are considerably smaller. And this is a problem for at least the minimal spectrum ground unified theories, although I don't think it's a particularly big problem. So where are we with these ground unified theories? As I said, we've got one successful prediction, namely sine squared theta w, one halfway successful prediction, namely the mass of the bottom quark, and one unsuccessful prediction, which is bearing decay. Something else which was successful, in a way, was neutrino masses. These are a natural feature of ground unified theories. In fact, from a fundamental point of view, there's no particular reason why neutrinos should have zero mass. The only sacred symmetries of quantum field theory are gauge symmetries. So, for example, electromagnetic charge is conserved because it's related to a massless photon, which is related to the unbroken gauge symmetry of the standard model. If you wanted to guarantee that the neutrino would remain massless, you would have to discover an exact gauge symmetry, for example, lepton number, which would preserve the masslessness of the neutrino. So we know that there is no such gauge symmetry. There is no massless gauge boson around which could exactly conserve lepton number. So it's hardly surprising that if you use your imagination a little bit, you can come up with perfectly legal models in which neutrinos have non-zero masses. And that's exactly what happens in ground unified theories, and for that matter, also in string theories. Now, in fact, you could even generate a neutrino mass just using purely standard model particles at the expense of introducing a non-normalizable interaction. This is something that I mentioned in my second lecture when I was talking about the electroweak fits predicting a relatively light Higgs boson mass. I said, well, that was true, but it could be modified if you had additional non-normalizable interactions, higher dimensional interactions. And just such a higher dimensional interaction might generate neutrino masses. On the other hand, most people don't like non-normalizable interactions. Most people think that that's just a way of describing the exchange of some massive particle, and in the case of neutrino masses, that would be some massive right-handed neutrino. So the scenario that most people would consider is where you have left-handed neutrinos, which are doublets of the SG2 gauge group, right-handed neutrinos, which are singlets of the SG2 gauge group. Those couple together through some sort of Yukawa interaction, much in the same way that quarks and charged leptons get masses. But in addition, there would be a coupling of these two right-handed neutrinos, which I've written here by M. Now you put that into your mass matrix and you diagonalize it, and you find that naturally the mass of the light neutrino, which is almost entirely a pure left-handed neutrino, is naturally order 1 over m, given by a formula much like that. So, in order to do this, what you need is this additional right-handed singlet neutrino field, and if you put in the numbers, the natural range for the masses is something like 10 to the 10 to 10 to the 15 GeV. So that sounds like something which you would expect to find in a grand unified theory. You don't necessarily need to postulate a grand unified theory if you want to deduce neutrino masses, but that would be the most natural scenario. So the simplest grand unified theory that I showed you a moment ago, SU5, does not contain such a single neutrino field N unless you just add it in by hand. On the other hand, if you look at the next smallest grand unified group, SO10, then this additional singlet neutrino field appears in a very natural way. So previously I talked about looking at groups of rank 4, and I said, well, SU5 is basically the only possibility. You can do a similar analysis for the next set of groups with rank 5, and looking for groups with complex representations, the only suitable candidate is SO10. And SO10, it turns out, has an irreducible 16-dimensional representation which contains the 10 and 5 bar of SU5, and in addition, it contains a singlet, which is ideal for being the right-hand neutrino. So, neutrino masses arise in a very natural way as soon as you consider grand unified theories, and in particular, consider non-minimal grand unified theories. I would say that neutrino masses become almost inevitable. So, I'm not going to say I didn't have enough time to discuss any more neutrino masses and mixing. It's something which is difficult to explore at the LHC, although not entirely impossible. Maybe I pause for just a second here to catch my breath. Any comments or questions before I finish off with a few minutes about string? Which of course is less than it occurs. Basically the standard model Higgs, but now expanded to a full gut representation. That's this five-dimensional Higgs version. But then you need another completely different type of Higgs to break the original grand unified symmetry down to SU3 plus SU2 plus U1. And this has to have a different internal group theoretical structure, and it also has to have a very much larger vacuum expectation value. So it'd be a completely novel type of Higgs. Questions, comments? Okay, so just a few final words about string theory. We've retained this, by the way. I've shown you what are the basically only possible gut groups of rank 4 and rank 5. The next rank is 6, and there is a candidate grand unified group of rank 6. It's actually something which appears very naturally in string theory. Okay, so according to string theory, as you know, you replace elementary particles by extended objects. So historically, the first extended objects that people considered were indeed strings. Nowadays, actually, people realize that you also have to, for the consistency of the theory, include higher dimensional extended objects that are called membranes. So the name string theory is, in some sense, a sort of historical relic. But nevertheless, that's what people call it. So, string theory was actually discovered more or less by accident by Gabriele Veneziano when he was on a boat back in 1969. He was sailing from Israel to Europe and he came up with the idea of string theory. Well, actually, what he was trying to do was trying to make a model of the strong interactions, building on early work that he and others had been doing. And at the time, he didn't realize it was string theory. Subsequently, people discovered that it had this very beautiful internal mathematical structure. For a while, until somewhere around 1973, people persisted in trying to use string theory as a model of the strong interactions. But then QCD came along, asymptotic freedom was discovered, people said, shucks, what's string useful for? Just shortly after that, these guys suggested, well, okay, maybe it's not a theory of the strong interactions, but maybe it could actually be a theory of everything, a theory of gravity. So this is where the interest in string theory has largely centered since then, although not only. So let's focus just for a moment on this quantum gravity interpretation of string theory. So quantum gravity is kind of, we say, irrelevant to everyday life, the LHC, or even to the linear collider. Of course, if you had a sufficiently high energy collider, then it began to become a problem because gravitational forces would become comparable to the other forces. But that only happens when you get to energies of order n Planck, so it's not going to happen with the LHC. Now, what happens is that when you get up to these very high energies, and when you try to calculate quantum corrections in Einstein gravity, for example, you get infinite answers. And the Einstein formulation of gravity is actually non-normalizable. We just don't know how to get sensible and finite results out of it. There's another difficulty with quantum gravity, as we understand it naively, which is that it would appear to permit pure states to evolve into mixed quantum mechanical states. And the basic mechanism is illustrated here. Imagine that you have a particle-antiparticle pair, which is produced close to a black hole. Then you lose one of them into the black hole, the other one escapes. The information about the one that fell into the black hole is lost, and that means that the particle that escapes is necessarily in a mixed state, where you have to do some sort of sum over all the possible states of the thing that disappeared. Now, in conventional quantum mechanics, it's not possible for a pure state to evolve into a mixed state. Pure states remain pure, mixed states remain mixed. So Hawking, in particular, in the 1970s, was arguing that this indicated that there was a fundamental conflict between quantum theory and gravity. More recently, he sort of changed his mind a little bit, and he's not so sure anymore whether there really is a conflict. But I think it's still, to my mind, an unresolved issue. Anyway, the suggestion of string theory for addressing these problems is, as I mentioned, that you replace point-like objects by extended objects, such as, for example, strings or more complicated objects. Now, the quantum consistency of the theory determines for you the number of dimensions. I also remember when this was first realized, people did calculations of quantum effects in string theory, and they said, oh shit, it doesn't make any sense unless we've got 26 dimensions. So at the point, that was kind of, at the time, that was kind of a problem. Nowadays, it's sort of become a trademark, which people are rather proud of. Anyway, in a purely bosonic string, you need 26 dimensions, and if you make it supersymmetric, then you need 10 dimensions. So string theory necessarily requires some extra dimensions. Now, clearly, we only see 3 plus 1 dimensions, and so you have to get rid of those surplus dimensions somehow, and initially, at least, it was thought that those extra dimensions would be extremely small, inaccessible to the LHC, and order one over the Planck length in size. And I said that this is supposed to be not only a quantum theory of gravity, but also a quantum theory of everything. And in fact, in these string theories, you can calculate what the grand unification scale should be. And it turns out to be a few times 10 to the 17 GeV, somewhere close to M Planck. So that's, you know, close to, but not exactly, the grand unification scale that we mentioned earlier on in the lecture. So this led to a little bit of heart searching. So one of the solutions which has been suggested is that, in fact, if there is an extra dimension which appears below the grand unification scale, then you might actually be able to bring the grand unification scale into agreement with the string scale. And that's what's illustrated here. I don't have time to discuss the scenario in great detail, but the idea was that if you brought one of the extra dimensions down a little bit below the grand unification scale, then gravity would grow stronger quicker, and it might actually meet up with the grand unified theory coupling that we had earlier on in the lecture, and that could then be a scenario for having everything unified at the same scale, somewhere around 10 to the 16 GeV. And, well, this is just a bunch of jargon words to say this is one particular scenario in which this happened. You've got four large dimensions, which are the ones that we know and love. There are some very, very small dimensions, and then there is this other dimension, which is one that brings gravity together with the other forces. So what happened then? Well, people said, well, if these extra dimensions of string theory no longer have to be extremely small, but could be somewhat larger than the Planck length, then maybe they could be a lot larger. And this is why people came up with the idea that extra dimensions might be observable at colliders, and in particular at the LHC. So, in particular, Antoniadis came up with the idea that these extra dimensions might be at the TeV scale, that might help you break supersymmetry. In my second lecture, I discussed also the possibility that these, to one TeV extra dimension, might help you break electroweak symmetry. Then people were even more brave or foolhardy, and they said, well, maybe it could be micron size that would help you rewrite the hierarchy problem. Maybe they could even be infinite in size. Remember in the second lecture I mentioned very briefly a scenario for the Higgs boson called holographic technicolor, which involves a scenario where you've got an infinite extra dimension. Anyway, all this theoretical speculation has led to various suggestions for things that you might look for at colliders. And so let me finish these lectures just by mentioning a couple of examples. So one, of course, is the infamous black hole. And here we have a black hole, simulation of a black hole produced in the Atlas detector, which we would expect to decay, emitting Hawking radiation. So as you remember, Walter Wagner is very concerned that there is a 50-50 chance that the LHC might produce these things and destroy the planet. Well, I think it would be great if we found them, not so great if we destroyed the planet, but I don't think that's going to happen. And another scenario is that you might produce Kaluza-Klein excitations. And this is one simulation done by Brian Weber and collaborators, showing you how a Kaluza-Klein excitation of a graviton, which of course has spin 2, might be produced at the LHC. Its decay would have an angular distribution which would be completely different from that of a normal scalar or vector resonance. So, these are just two of the ways of looking for extra dimensions at colliders. The amount that I believe in extra dimensions and the amount that I believe in supersymmetry are roughly speaking in relation to the amount of time I spent discussing the two topics. Just forestall the obvious question. So, I finish. Sorry for running over time, but those are the breaks. So, I think most theorists would agree that the origin of mass is the most pressing problem in particle physics. It's something which requires a solution at the TeV scale. The placeholder solution is the Higgs boson, but that's not necessarily correct. It might not be the whole story, it might not be the story at all. It might be supplemented by supersymmetry, or it might be some sort of composite thing, perhaps related to extra dimensions. Only the LHC will be able to tell. Now, we theorists can speculate until the cows come home, but it's you experimentalists working on the LHC that will tell us the answer. So there's plenty of other speculative ideas for other physics beyond the standard model, grand unification, string theory, etc., etc., etc. Maybe some hints in that direction have been provided by neutrinos. However, these speculations about very, very high energy physics are very difficult to test experimentally. There are some possibilities at the LHC if we should be so lucky enough that there really are extra dimensions. But as I said, don't hold your breath. Anyway, thank you.
Squeeze